For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week we've got buckets of books for the summer break. Ellen Alpston returns with The Tsarina's Daughter, her next chapter in the astounding true story of the Russian royal family in the 18th century. We hear about CKBK, Spotify for cookbooks. Lynn Livingston brings us some great news about a flock of penguins coming into the RNIB library. And Claire Entwistle tells us how lockdown inspired her to write a memoir about her life with nystagmus. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Ellen Alpston first appeared on the show last year to tell us about her dramatic debut, Tsarina, the story of Peter the Great's wife, who began life as a serf named Marta and ended up as a Tsarina called Catherine and then became ruler of Russia. Now Ellen is back with her sequel, The Tsarina's Daughter, which picks up where Tsarina left off, in the Romanov court in 1727. Ellen, welcome back to Read On.
Thank you so much for welcoming me once more, Ed.
So we're back in the Romanov court in 1827, pretty much where we left Tsarina.
Absolutely. On the 8th of July, I'm going to publish the second book in the planned quartet of the Tsarina series. So last year, we spoke about my debut, Tsarina, about the most powerful woman history ever forgot, Catherine the First of Russia, not Catherine the Great. And now we are back with her daughter, Elizabeth, or Lizenka, as I lovingly call her, because that was her pet name. And Tsarina's daughter, really, she does her mother honor. She's a roller coaster ride called Romanov. And in a way, she lives her mother's story. Her mother, we remember, rose from serf to the first ruling empress of Russia ever. She lives her mother's story in verse, because she falls from riches to rags and then rises from rags to Romanov, which I just love.
And she is born into this wonderful, rather progressive court. Peter the Great was a great reformer, but it is still Byzantine in its intrigues and its viciousness. But she seems to have it all as a little girl, and her father even plans to marry her to Louis the 15th.
It really seemed like that. She was hailed as Europe's most lovely princess, and thus probably the world's most lovely princess, of course, in her day. Curiously enough, even though Peter the Great was so ambitious for his country and, you know, founded schools and universities, her own education was rather lackluster because she was a bit of a tomboy. She loved tearing through the countryside on horseback. She loved going skating. She loved singing with the peasants, dancing with them. She had every palace to her disposal, but actually she preferred camping. She liked dressing up as a man, equally because it accentuated her curvy hips and her long legs. Indeed, Louis Caravac painted her when that possible match with Louis XV was in the cards. And if we look at the portrait today, she really looks like a young Marilyn Monroe, incredibly dewy-eyed and rosy-cheeked. And one foreign envoy said about her, she doesn't have an ounce of nun's flesh on her body, in which he carefully expressed that she had equally inherited her parents' sensuous appetites, which is, of course, a bit tricky for a woman in the 18th century.
And being her suitor was dangerous during the time of Peter the Great, but once he died, rather suddenly, it became pretty much a death sentence.
Absolutely, because at the death of her parents, so Peter the Great, and then her mother took over the reign for 2 years' time as Catherine the Great, Elizabeth's fortunes turned quite dramatically and friends became foes, masks started to fall, because what was at stake was really the throne of the world's most powerful and rich realm, Russia, with millions of souls. Nothing was as abundant and superfluous as human life, really. And that was, of course, a merciless fight. And all of a sudden, she finds herself from having been this doted, adored princess. She is destitute. She is derided. She is absolutely ignored, pushed aside, threatened by death. And yes, there's one man who stands by her, who promises to always speak up for her, and he has to pay one of the highest possible prices. He gets away with his life by the skin of his teeth, but it is an horrific punishment he suffered for loving her, for supporting her. And it was one of the hardest scenes to write in the book. Again, like when I did my research for Tsarina, I was so shocked at the utter ruthlessness of life in that Russian Baroque, and at the ingenuity people developed in torturing each other, in killing each other, constantly trying to having one up on each other. But possibly things haven't changed that much in Russia. If you read The Tsarina's Daughter, you will understand a lot about Russia, what it is like today and why it is as it is today.
There's a wonderful quote by Daisy Goodwin that the Romanov court makes Game of Thrones look like a nursery rhyme. And it really is brutal, isn't it?
It is absolutely brutal. Nobody can trust anybody. Her father's oldest friend becomes Elizabeth's biggest enemy. Another man who has everything to thank for to her parents. Really, she has to cheat death at every corner because he tries to set up trap after trap after trap. Very often, death intervenes in the most shocking, untimely or timely manner. I don't want to give any spoilers, but at two very important moments of her life, somebody is so swiftly taken away exactly on that big day when something should happen. It is unbelievable, but it's actually the truth. Everything happened like that. So how she kept her wits together throughout all this danger, this constant threat. Every morning she never knew if she would see the sunset, if she would see the sunset in liberty, or if she would be indeed alive. So just her sheer force of character and her mental stamina are incredible.
You introduce an element of magical realism into her story as well, that she learns a prophecy in her youth, that her fate is tied up with that of Russia. Is that your invention, or is that something you found in your historical research?
Oh, that's very well spotted, Red. It is actually both, because she was born in the crumbling timber palace of Kolomenskoye, which was the first gift that Peter the Great made his then lover. And Elizabeth was born there. She was born out of wedlock. So she was later on haunted by that because people said she wasn't entitled to the Russian throne. Her parents hadn't been married when she was born, even though they got married later on. And Kolomenskoye is really a palace which was left from olden days. It was more dreamlike as opposed to the disorder of Moscow and the beautiful planned St. Petersburg. And it is set close to a brook and woodland that is called the Golosov Ravine. And around this Golosov Ravine, there were always rumors of time travel and rumors of it being haunted. And when I came across that in my research, I looked into it a little bit more. And for my general research, I had equally read a lot of fairy tales, a lot of Russian myths, because nothing gives you access to a people's imaginary as reading their fairy tales, their sagas and their myths. So much is hidden in there. And I realized that in Russia, no spirit is ever good. They're all ill-willing. And there's something about the Russian hierarchy that even transpires into the mystical world. And so, yes, I do have her climb down into this ravine. I do have her encounter a forest-dwelling spirit who even claims that already Peter the Great had to deal with her. And that spirit gives her a Delphic prophecy. And that Delphic prophecy, as you know, can be always, there are two ways to read it. You think you know, but actually the opposite of it might be true. And she turns the words in Elizabeth's mouth. And this dark prophecy, she realizes, is in the end not a threat, but more like a choker of dark pearls that prepares her for all the fights and all the troubles and all the danger that lie ahead of her before she meets the man who is to make her a very unlikely love story. She is already who she is, but this love allows her to become who she always was. So it is equally a big love story next to everything else.
Which, again, is a wonderful reflection of her mother's story. Love was absolutely at the heart of Catherine I's story with Peter the Great.
Yes, again, she lived the mother's story in inverse. When if Peter the Great fell in love with Catherine I when she was a prisoner of war and a washermaid and an illiterate serf, actually Elizabeth meets her man in similar desperate circumstances for her. He is, in a way, on the up. And their meeting is like a fairy tale. Their love is like a fairy tale, that she was able to foster this love and live it. I don't want to say anything more, because otherwise it's a massive spoiler again, who he is and how they actually get together and how he gives her the strength to do what she had to do. Because in the end, when she takes what is hers, she does have to pay a terrible, terrible price for it, the highest price possible. But he gives her the strength to do it, and he loves her even so. And funny enough, in my research, I read in the diaries of Catherine the Great as well. And she says about this man, nobody was ever as loved in Russia as he was because of his modesty. He was a good man, and that is rarer than black snow in Russia in those days.
And it is remarkable that his reign ushered in a century of rule by women in Russia in the 18th century. It's actually remarkably progressive.
It's incredible that this unique century of female reign happened so early, flying in the face of this brutal male-dominated society, this patriarchy that suppressed anything, any idea of female freedom. But there's equally a very interesting quote, if you cue almost 100 years back, by a great-great uncle of Elizabeth called Nikita Romanov. And he said, "Our family is as cursed. Our men are as meek as maidens, and our women are as wild as wolverines." So there is something genetic in the Romanovs, perhaps as it equally was in the Tudors, who struggled to have healthy, strong boys. Peter the Great was in a way the only healthy, strong male heir that was born in the House of Romanov in 100 years, and possibly through the injection of very fresh blood, because his mother was the second wife of the aging Tsar Alexis, and much, much younger than him. And this curse was only broken later by Catherine the Great, whose son Paul, Pavel, was probably not a Romanov at all, but who was fathered by her lover, Sergei Saltykov. But I'm going ahead of myself and of a novel I want to write later on.
Well, I was going to say, we've had Catherine I, we've had Elizabeth. Presumably, you're working on a novel about Catherine the Great?
I'm going to surprise you all, Red, because actually not. The novel about Catherine the Great is planned to be the last one in the quartet. And at the moment, I am writing a prequel to Tsarina about this stunning woman, Peter the Great's mother. Without her, he would have never become who he was, because she, so young, grew up in the German or Western suburb of Moscow, and was very westernized in times when women lived hidden, almost harem-like, in a terem. She walked around without a veil in the house of her warden where she grew up, who was married to a Scottish lady, so she was partial to whiskey at the young age of 17 and 18. They invited actors, they had plays, people came, discussed, and amongst those people who were invited for supper one evening was equally the aging Tsar Alexis. But I can't say much more, because it's a wonderful story unfolding there at the moment, and again, a fight to life and death for the throne of Russia.
I remember when we spoke last year, you said that Catherine I felt almost a bit of a soulmate for you. She'd been so much part of your life for so long, and you have a real affection for her. Did you feel the same for Elizabeth?
I felt the same for Lizenka, because she's a survivor in a different way. The more I did research into her, I felt how desperately lonely she was. And we all know, especially after the past year, I think so many people have suffered from being lonely, and what it means to pluck yourself up every day and get going, and to believe that somewhere at the end of this dark, dark tunnel, it might actually become the end of the rainbow. That's a very strong feature in her. And like Catherine the First, like Tsarina herself, the Tsarina's daughter, again, is a very, very modern woman. So once more, we have this framework in the novel of very strict historical research. And within that framework, her story is woven really in a tapestry large enough to cover a wall in the Winter Palace. And she is such a vivid and strong and lively character that, yes, once more, I'm obsessed with my leading lady, my girls, as I call them. It's a privilege to have discovered her, because once more, the Tsarina's Daughter, unbelievably enough, is the first novel proper published about Elizabeth's weight, power, her arduous ascent. And another point that I found very interesting during my research is that she's really the other Elizabeth. And that was a wonderful link to the UK, obviously, where I live and work. Because if you think about it, Elizabeth Tudor and her, Elizabeth Romanov, they were both the second daughter born into a quite young royal dynasty. They had this overwhelming father figures, Henry VIII, Peter the Great. Their mothers were derided. The real old queen was still alive. No male heir was forthcoming. For more than a decade, they had to struggle for survival against a very jealous, older female monarch. They came to power when nobody thought they would. In the end, they both stayed barren, childless, and they died in a river palace, leaving the throne to an unloved nephew. I find these are such similarities. So I've written a couple of features sort of to the theme of the other Elizabeth. And she was equally the first people's princess. So there are lots of modern hooks in the story, which I loved when writing.
Well, I'm sure that just like Tsarina, the book is going to find its way into an awful lot of people's holiday reading bag. And for fans of audiobooks, we again have the great treat of Anna Cripper narrating the book.
Yes, Anna is really incredible. The soul and the stamina she has to read these huge stories. And of course, her background is perfect. She's Anglo-Russian and she understands the pronunciation. She understands the world. I even now, when I write the prequel, I sometimes write to her and I said, how would you say this? How would you address somebody in that position? How do you greet a Russian Orthodox Pope? Do you kiss their ring as the Catholics do? These are details I want to be correct. And on top of it, actually, I mean, I don't want to say too much, but there is at the moment a film and TV treatment being offered. So we have to see what comes of that. I mean, Anna even fits the bill visually. So we have to see what comes of that, Red.
My little cousin, Ivan, is innocent. He is a baby and as pure as only a one-year-old can be. But tonight, at my order, the infant Tsar will be declared guilty as charged. I fight the urge to pick him up and kiss him. It would only make things worse. Beyond his nursery door, there is a low buzzing sound, like that of angry bees ready to swarm the Winter Palace. Soldiers' boots scrape and shuffle. Spurs clink like stubby vodka glasses and bayonets are being fixed to muskets. These are the sounds of things to come. The thought spikes my heart with dread. There is no other choice. It is Ivan or me. Only one of us can rule Russia. The other one condemned to a living death.
Anna Cripper narrating The Tsarina's Daughter, written by my guest, Ellen Alpston. Well, that's fantastically exciting news about the film treatment. Again, it just beggars belief that you are rediscovering these stories for a modern audience and that they're not part of our everyday conversation. Do you still have to pinch yourself to believe that nobody came across Tsarina and the Tsarina's Daughter stories before?
I absolutely do. In a way, I feel they were hiding in plain sight. I believe I compared Tsarina to Tutankhamun at the time. Tutankhamun too was always there, just as Tsarina, Catherine I, or the Tsarina's daughter, Empress Elizabeth, were. But the Tsars preceding them, such as Peter the Great and even Ivan the Terrible, going one family further back, and the Tsars succeeding them, such as Catherine the Great, or the last Tsars, the ill-fated Nikolai II and Alexandra, shed so much light and made so much noise that they slid into the shadows of history. So you can compare it perhaps a little bit to the other Boleyn girl. Mary Rose Boleyn was always there, but Anne Boleyn made such a racket by nabbing the king that nobody looked at her. And it was by finding this fresh viewpoint to the story that Philippa Gregory made her fantastic career. Perhaps Hilary Mantel would have never written the Wolf Hall series without the other Boleyn girl, because it showed the value of a fresh viewpoint onto a known story.
Well, like Hilary Mantel, you are providing us with wonderful food for thought that is both entertaining and educational. And Ellen Alpston, I hope you'll come back onto the show with the third part of the quartet in due course.
Oh, what a fantastic compliment. Thank you so much. I shall be looking forward to that, Red, and all my love to all your listeners.
Both Tsarina and the Tsarina's Daughter are out now in ebook, print and audio, wherever you buy your books. And Ellen Alpston will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
Talking Books has two shows per day, one at 8 a.m. and the other at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime.
My name is Jim Broadbent and I'm delighted to be reading the Talking Books.
Enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library morning, afternoon or evening.
This is Julia Donaldson and you're listening to Talking Books.
And for younger listeners or the young at heart, Children's Talking Books is on every Saturday at 9, Sunday at 3 or Tuesday at 6 p.m. Books for all ages all through the day, only on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. Still to come in this week's show, we've got some exciting news about a huge donation to the RNIB Talking Books Library. And Claire Entwistle will share her story about life with nystagmus. But first, if like me you're a keen cook who misses your recipe books, here's some news to get your mouth watering.
It's billed as Spotify for cookbooks. CKBK is an online subscription service offering access to hundreds of cookbooks and tens of thousands of mouthwatering recipes. And it's perfect for those of us who love cooking but can't see to read a physical cookbook. I spoke to co-founder Matt Cockerell. So Matt, tell us a little bit more about CKBK.
I've been passionate about cooking for many years, but it increasingly struck me that what we had in the world of great cookbooks, which brought together some humanity's knowledge about cooking, had been left behind, essentially, in terms of really embracing digital technologies, even though so much of food was happening online with Instagram and things like that. The really high quality content from really well-known chefs and authors was still primarily existing in these printed books. And it seemed really a missed opportunity. We were discovering new music through services like Spotify, being able to explore all kinds of classic movies and new content on Netflix. And why was it that in the world of food, we were still essentially dealing with the printed page? So that was the driver for us in really saying, okay, in the digital world, things like a novel can benefit from being an audiobook or maybe being on Kindle. But that's not such a great fit for a book full of recipes. How could we make a digital platform that would really make the most of great food content in cookbooks, but really then bring it to your phone and to an online environment and make the most of the ability there to connect it up with different technologies, whether that's integrating with online groceries, converting measurements for different things. And then it turned out one of the surprising benefits for us of bringing this content together on a digital platform was we heard from visually impaired users that suddenly they had much easier access to all the content in these cookbooks because all of the accessibility technologies within their devices were able finally to help them explore and get straight to their favorite recipes from a particular cookbook author.
And that has recently been fully endorsed by blind food blogger Laura Facci, who's also a Paralympic gold medalist.
Absolutely. It was the power of social media, really. One of our visually impaired cooking fans, a guy called Adrian Higginbottom, was tweeting about cookbook And Laura came across that tweet and was like, why hadn't I heard about this before? And she ended up writing a really nice piece on her blog about how Cookbook had helped her to discover all these books she'd previously not had access to but wanted to. And the great thing was she also listed some of the books and authors she'd really like to see on the platform, including Nisha Katona, the founder of Mowgli's Street Food. And it turned out Nisha's books were with one of our partner publishers, and we were able to bring those books right onto the platform within just a few weeks. And there's been a lot of enthusiasm from authors such as Nisha Katona, who think this is a fantastic opportunity to make their work so much more accessible.
It's not only some of the biggest names in cooking. I believe you've also got quite a good selection of out of print or very hard to get cookbooks, such as George Lang's The Cuisine of Hungary, which for those of us with Hungarian roots is a terrific way to find out the best goulash recipe on the face of the planet.
It's funny you should mention that, indeed. Anybody who has Hungarian heritage, they say, oh, do you have George Lang? And they are so impressed to hear. We do indeed. And the reason for that is our starting point when setting out to bring together cookbooks that were really kind of desert island cookbooks, cookbooks that were worth preserving, was to ask the current generation of top chefs and authors, what have you read? What really influences you? What are the books you still go back to? And so we got those recommendations, these top 10 lists, and they covered everything from some of the most recent books, which were instant classics. So, for example, authors like Jos Motulenghi obviously are hugely influential right now, but Jos Motulenghi shared his top 10 books, and those included people like MFK Fisher and Claudia Roden. And so building this picture of the most significant books of all time, we were then able to go out and track those books down. And many of them, as you mentioned, are sadly out of print. And so it's been great for those authors, or in some cases, the descendants of those authors, to see those real classic works being rediscovered and now made available to a new generation of cooks. And not only that, not just any cook, but also even visually impaired cooks can have access through the platform.
How many books have you got on the platform so far?
So we're rolling out new books every week, in fact, and there's more than 500 online already. That's well over 100,000 recipes. And then all the non-recipe content too, which really provides that context about the culture. And as you, for example, with The Cuisine of Hungary, there's so much more to it just being a goulash recipe. You find the whole history there.
And for anybody who's rather wary of signing up to the $4.99 a month, you can actually access up to 3 recipes free per month, I believe.
That's right. As a free member, you get to search the whole content and to explore and browse and get a taster of up to 3 recipes a month. And then we have a 14-day free trial if you want to dig deeper and explore in an unlimited way the premium membership.
How would listeners find you online?
So Cookbook is spelled CKBK, and you can either search on the App Store or just Google CKBK to find the website.
Do you have a favourite recipe in amongst those 100,000?
Well, at the moment, I'm a big Japanese cooking fan, and I am somewhat well known for having a very large patch of wasabi in my garden. So anything basically which makes good use of my fresh wasabi is my current favourite in the kitchen.
Fantastic. I'm going to explore my own heritage through Mr. Lang a little bit further. But in the meantime, Matt Cockerell, thank you so much for coming on to tell us more about CKBK.
Thank you.
And great news. Since we recorded that interview, Matt has told me that he set up a 25% discount code for RNIB customers. The code is RNIB25 and can be claimed at checkout. For more information, visit the CKBK online chat or the support feature on the website. This is Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. Now, here's some great news from the RNIB Library.
The RNIB Talking Books Library is constantly acquiring new titles, but at the moment it's just started a major growth spurt. Here's Lynn Livingston, the library's Collection Development Executive, to give us an update. Lynn, what's the news?
So, we have recently signed an agreement with Penguin Random House for them to give us their entire back catalogue and all their books going forward as well. It's an amazing agreement for us. The back catalogue has about 6,000 titles in it, and that is across all the imprints. So, for instance, if you see a book that is Transworld or Vintage or Ebury, Cornerstone, it's actually under that umbrella as well. So it's a massive range of books. And within that, of course, there's something for absolutely everybody in there. It covers everything, including the Penguin Classics series. So Penguin have recently restarted recording their Penguin Classics. And we have the classics in the library currently, but you know, some of our recordings are rather elderly now, and the recording quality back in the day wasn't so great. So what we're trying to do is we're updating with these lovely brand spanking new recordings that Penguin are giving to us as well. The other thing that is fabulous is that over the years, people have asked us for more drama in the library, more humour in the library. And also included within this collection is the BBC digital recordings. So these are the radio shows that go out across the BBC. So we have radio drama, we have the humorous shows that go out, and also some archive recordings as well. So over time, we will be able to get those into the library as well, which will really increase the content in those particular areas. But also, I'm particularly excited because every month we get customer requests in and we take a note of every single book that people ask for. And if we can possibly get it, we pursue avenues to get it into the library. And over the years, we have been waiting for this agreement with Penguin Random House. So I've been building up a huge list of books that people would like to read. And when that agreement became live, I just handed over the list of all the books that people wanted. There were over 500 titles there, and Penguin went, yes, that's lovely, here you go. So all those books that people have been waiting years and years for are now in the library, and that includes a whole series that we've been waiting years for. We've been waiting years for the James Patterson Alex Cross series, for the Lee Child Jack Reacher series, finishing off the Clive Cussler series, the Kate Atkinson, Nikki French, some Robert Harris titles, Jack Sheffield, who's a huge customer favourite. All these books are now in the library thanks to Penguin Random House, and we are so incredibly grateful. Just knowing that our readers are going to be so happy with what we are able to give them now is such a joy for us. And also the books going forward are coming in and will be simultaneously published. So for instance, tomorrow I have 7 books which are hitting the bookshelves in the bookshops, and they're also going to be hitting our library as well. So by the end of the year, we will have the new Susan Hill carrying on the Simon Sirelius series. We'll have the follow-up to the incredibly popular Thursday Murder Club by Richard Osmond. We will have the new Jack Reacher coming out in October, and the new one in the Anthony Horowitz series. And those are only just a taster of what's coming. There's so many big authors who are published by Penguin Random House, and every single one of these big titles will be coming to us as well. So it's such a joy for us.
Wow, that is incredible news, Lynn. I mean, that just sounds, in print terms, like several tons of books. Over 6,000 titles in the back catalogue alone. Is it just you processing these books?
Well, there is a reason why we can't just put 6,000 books in the library in one go. And one of the reasons is me doing the cataloguing. So, yeah, it takes time. But the other reason is that we get the master files in from Penguin Random House, and then we turn them into DAISY, which makes them much more accessible for our readers. So there is a process that has to be gone through to get them into the library. And then thereafter, there is another process to upload them to the Reading Services platform for download. So the download books take a little bit longer. They are not simultaneously published on the actual day that the books hit the bookshelves. That is only for USB and CD. However, every book will be going up on the reading platform as well. So don't fear, you just have to wait just a hint longer than the folk who are getting them on CD and USB. But there are over 50 books a month coming in, published on the date. So it's incredibly exciting for us.
Well, that's brilliant. And those, of course, will be your priority. And I know that you have your list of requests from users of the library who are keen to get hold of a specific title. And I know that they can carry on writing into you and at risk of creating even more work for you. How would they drop you a line to put in a request for something from the back catalogue?
Well, they can call up our helpline and leave a message with them or talk to our reader services team. And if this is a book that has been published in the past and we haven't yet got it into the library, then I will stick it on a list and get that expedited and get it in as soon as possible.
As ever, Lynn, you are working incredibly hard for all our benefits. And I know I'm not alone in saying thank you for helping make even more brilliant titles accessible to those of us who can't read print. And thanks hugely to Penguin Random House.
Thank you very much. It's so appreciated and it makes us so happy knowing that we can make people happy.
For more information, check out the rniblibrary.com website or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Connect Radio. And now, before we return to Ellen Alpston to hear the books of her life, Penguin Random House are not alone in donating books to the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Many of us in the BVI community live with medical conditions with long, complicated, often Latin names. And that in itself can just add to the complications. It's an issue that Claire Entwistle, who has nystagmus, has lived with throughout her life. And now she's written a book about it, called What Seems to Be the Trouble?
It's a book that I wrote during lockdown last year because I realised it was a book I had to write and it felt like cataclysmic times that made me get on with it. It's basically a memoir of my experiences of living with one of those health problems which are not well understood by professionals at all. And it's about my journey, and it really has been a journey to find something that helps and to understand it better. And my journey has been extremely funny at times and sometimes extremely painful, or pretty excruciating, really. And there have been moments of feeling alienated from so-called normal people, but also a lot of moments of getting very close to other people, closer than I might have without the disability. And I've tried to convey all this in the book. Somebody asked me if it was a misery memoir. It definitely is not. There's much more about hope in it and laughter and pleasure, as well as talking about the difficulties of having a disability.
You certainly do seem to manage to find the funny side of things, but at its root, this is an exploration of how even the name of a medical condition can just turn people off if they don't understand, if it's not something that's treatable with aspirin or a stitches or an operation. There's almost a sense of, oh, well, you're on your own then.
It does feel like that sometimes. And I think I'm extremely far from being alone in having something that's hard to describe. I definitely have nystagmus, which is involuntary eye movement. That has a name. But even medics are not always that familiar with it or able to understand it. I say in the book, I had an experience of going to Moorfields and I had to spell it and define it to the ophthalmic nurse who took my notes. So it's really kind of that unknown. But also I have nystagmus because probably I have a tiny bit of brain damage, they think, although they don't really know, that was caused before I was born. And that has other effects apart from the involuntary eye movements. I don't have any sight in my right eye at all. And I have great problems with balance and dizziness and nausea. I'm always putting my neck out. You know, they're all kind of connected. But it's my particular cocktail of problems. Other visually impaired people often have their own cocktail of problems too. And so do people with all kinds of other conditions like irritable bowel syndrome and ME and MS. So many other things that are just really hard to describe and understand.
And in the book, you say just how important it is to find your tribe, to find people who do have to live with the same issues as you do and the complications that those throw into everyday life.
Yes, absolutely. And I didn't find my tribe for quite a long time. I was in my mid-30s, actually. I went through my younger years puzzles, really, about how difficult I found certain things. Things like catching a ball or spotting something across the room or having rather low endurance for things which seem quite easy to other people, like going around an art gallery. I find it absolutely exhausting. You know, I can only stand it for about 10 minutes. And it feels funny saying this to you, Rudd, you know, because I know that you've climbed mountains and done all sorts of amazing physical challenges. And I'm having to say that I find going around an art exhibition for more than about 10 minutes really exhausting. But I do, you know, it's a fact, I do find that. And I didn't find my tribe really till my mid-30s when I joined an organisation called the Nystagmus Network, which it's aimed at people with nystagmus, but like me, many people with nystagmus have other problems. Some don't, some just have nystagmus. And I was able to swap experiences with them, observe how they were managing things. And it was an unbelievably sustaining experience. I'm still extremely fond of those people that I met right back then, and it was very important for me.
In the book, which obviously follows your own journey, you also use fictional characters such as Rodney. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, well, Rodney kind of created himself when I was writing the first draft of the book. There seemed to be this kind of voice following me round through life saying, oh, but surely you should go to the doctor about that. Surely the doctors can do something about that. Aren't you being ridiculous not going to the doctor about that? And Rodney eventually sort of created himself really out of expressions like that. And in the book, he follows me around making well-meaning comments about things when he hears that I had two eye operations when I was very small, just aged 4 and 6. And I say how painful and awful and traumatizing that surgery was. I'm not saying it's like that for everybody, but for me, it was absolutely dreadful. And Rodney just says, oh, well, still, I expect you could see better after the operation, right? And I have to say, no, Rodney, I couldn't see better after the operation. It was supposed to change my head posture and it just returned to the same as before. It was supposed to help me look straight ahead. And then the medics just did it again 2 years later and it was awful again. And my head posture still returned. And Rodney's always left saying, yes, I know, but you really ought to do what doctors want. I say in the book that he just feels as if his experiences of conventional medicine are, they're just as if he belongs to a different species, really. I always tend to get the side effects. Medication affects me badly. Surgery affects me badly. Tests affect me badly. And Rodney just seems to sail through it all. He broke his leg and the hospital just set his leg. And then he had this lovely physiotherapist called Louise, who he thought he was wonderful. And he's kind of cured completely. And then his mother gets breast cancer, which is very worrying for the family, but she has the treatment and she's completely better. 10 years later, no more signs. And Rodney just lives in this parallel universe to me, really. I'm always having bad effects from things or they don't help at all.
Yes, I did wonder if Rodney was also a medical man. I certainly remember getting my diagnosis. And I think part of the problem was the consultant knew there was nothing that could be done about retinitis pigmentosa. And therefore, I was a failure in his eyes.
Yeah.
And I know that that kind of frustration with the medical world has led you into investigating alternative therapies as well.
Yes, it did. That was something I started fairly early on in my 20s. It's kind of upsetting to keep going to a doctor and either being told that you're probably making it up or you're imagining it, or, you know, they kept on telling me that I had ear infections because I was so dizzy, and I was sure that I didn't, but they didn't kind of understand that this is a neurological and a eyesight and light sensitivity kind of response. And so I thought maybe alternative practices might help. So I tried over the years many things. I started off with hypnotherapy, thinking it might calm my brain down a bit. I went to this hypnotherapist who insisted on me lying down with a bright light on me. And she said it was because she needed to read my expression. And I said that that's going to cause me a real problem. I won't be able to relax because I'm very light sensitive, even with my eyes closed. And she just said, oh, you'll be fine. And that was kind of the beginning of the whole thing. And then I went on from that to try all kinds of things, osteopathy and chiropractic and Bowen technique and things like that. And I tended to find that the practitioner would do me a lot of good in the very short term. And I'd feel much better immediately after the session. But within a few hours, always by the evening, I'd be having worse pains, musculoskeletal pains and headaches and neck pain and things, because I just had quite a sensitive system and it was a bit strung up by having to deal with me putting my head on one side because of the visual impairment for years and years. You know, I got quite out of alignment and I tended to just find I had this big reaction. And the same with yoga, actually, and Pilates and things like that. I'd enjoy it in the class and feel better, but then it would kind of ping back afterwards. So I also had a problem with explaining this to some of the alternative practitioners that I spoke to and did some work with.
Yes, I did find myself howling with laughter and howling with frustration. I've been on some of that journey myself. As you say, this is far from a misery memoir, and it has been brought to audiobook life by a rather wonderful narrator. Clearly, it was important for you to get it recorded as an audiobook. Can you tell us a bit about the process?
Yes, well, I had published it. I self-published it because I just thought, I'm just going to get this out there. I'm not going to spend ages sending it around publishers. And then I just thought I would love people who don't easily read print or even Kindles. I would love them to be able to access it because I'm sure there are many people who are much more visually impaired than I am or who are completely blind who I would love to be able to read it. And also if they felt like contacting me or writing a review, I would love to hear what they heard about it. So I just sent an email off to the RNIB library and said, might you be interested in recording this for your audio library? And I got a reply straight back saying yes. And as someone who has tried for a long time to publish books in the more general sector, I was just astonished by that, but I was so happy. And it's narrated by a very lovely lady called Jilly Bond, who does an amazing impersonation of my Argentinian voice coach. It's honestly, you could be him. She's got a great voice and great kind of variety of tone and so on. So I'm so happy that she's done it. Thank you, Jilly, if you're listening.
False Start seemed to be the story of my life. And just as I made one with therapy, so I did with yoga. The year after the lumberjack incident, Steve and I, both feeling for different reasons a need to stretch and relax, signed up for a weekly class. Iyengar for Beginners, as it was called, was taught by a woman called Jill, assisted by her partner, Bruno. The class took place in a church hall with a very dirty floor. The available space was long and thin, and the class popular, so we students laid out our mats close together in two long rows. Jill insisted on perfect alignment of mat as well as body, so the first minutes of each class were spent tugging at corners. Our blankets and straps, when not in use, had to be folded and placed on the outer edges of our mats. It was a bit like being in the army. Jill tended to give a lightning demo of each posture before prowling the hall to pounce on mistakes, and she was mostly positioned way beyond the scope of my detail vision. My ability to grasp what was required at first relied on the expertise of the student on my left. Until I explained about my eyesight and balance issues, whereupon Jill became alarmingly positive. Don't you worry about that. Bruno will help you. So when the command came to stand on one leg, or to form some triangular shape beyond my competence, Bruno would come marching through the ranks. His idea of helping was to get a good grip on various parts of my anatomy and yank them into the arrangement prescribed by Jill. Because he was a big, strong chap, and I didn't like to make a fuss, he usually succeeded. Whether it was yoga in any normal sense was another question.
Jilly Bond, narrating What Seems to Be the Trouble, written by my guest, Claire Entwistle. Now that you've written one book, are you tempted to sit down and maybe try your hand at fiction?
I did try to write a novel. In fact, I did write a novel, actually. It was a great long thing, based on my childhood experiences of growing up living in a haunted house, because I'm pretty sure the house I grew up in was haunted, and a lot of people said the same thing. And I did turn that into a novel, but actually I'm rewriting it more as another piece of life writing, just saying what was the truth about that house and how do houses come to seem to be haunted. So it's turned into a bit of an exploration of what home is really and how ambivalent you can feel about your home and how important it is. And it's also including some bits about having moved from London to Cumbria a few years ago, which is another exploration of home. So I'm working on that. Maybe I will write some fiction sometime, but I think life writing is the thing I really enjoy doing.
That sounds fascinating, and I hope you'll come back onto the show when you finished it to discuss it. But in the meantime, Claire Entwistle, thank you so much for coming onto the show and for donating your book to the R&IB Talking Books Library.
Thank you very much, Red. It's been brilliant. Thank you.
What Seems to Be the Trouble by Claire Entwistle is available now from the R&IB Talking Books Library. For more information, search the rniblibrary.com website or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Now it's back to Ellen Alpston for the books of her life.
So, Ellen, was there a book that you read as a youngster that made you fall in love with reading or want to become an author?
Yes, there was actually. I was born in the highlands of northern Kenya at the foot of mystical Mount Elgon, where life glows in technicolor, and in Africa, a tall tale is always appreciated, be it in the tribal tradition where myths and legends are passed on orally, or around the campfire on safari or during a long evening when the rains have come. My father was a vet. My mother taught in a local school. We had no TV, but a big garden and plenty of pets, amongst them at times a wounded serval cat, a grumpy polo pony called Calypso, and even a baby crocodile. And I had lots of books. So I read, I drew, I wrote diary, recording things like this morning there was a 9-foot python curled up in the tree above my swing. And once a month, I would receive a book parcel from my godmother in Germany. And the book that touched me most was The Brothers Lionheart by Astrid Lindgren. She's better known for her Pippi Longstocking character, but The Brothers Lionheart is the most incredibly spiritual and soulful book about the fight of these two brothers who live in a sort of afterworld. It's about good against evil and life against death. And it's profoundly touching. My 10-year-old son, Gustav, recently finished it. And once he had done so, he just came into my study for a long and silent hug because he was so touched by it. And if I ever write something similar, I'm a happy woman indeed.
Unfortunately, we couldn't find any English language versions of The Brothers Lionheart. But other books by Astrid Lindgren are available from the R&IB library, including this version of Pippi Longstocking, narrated by Tanya Emery, which is TB16158.
I've always heard that egg yolk is good for the hair, said Pippi, wiping her eye. You'll see that it will grow now so fast it creaks. In Brazil, for that matter, everyone goes about with egg in his hair. There's not a bald head to be seen. Once there was an old man who was so odd that he ate his eggs instead of spreading them on his hair. He turned quite bald too, and when he as much as showed himself on the streets, the traffic stopped and they had to call out the police. While she was talking, Pippi carefully picked out all the broken eggshell from the bowl with her fingers. Then she took a bath brush, which hung on the wall, and began beating the batter so that it splattered on the walls. At last she threw what was left on the griddle that stood on the stove. When the pancake was browned on one side, she threw it halfway to the ceiling so that it turned in the air and was caught in the pan again. And when it was done, she threw it across the kitchen so that it landed on a plate standing on the table. "Eat it!" she cried. "Eat it before it gets cold." Tommy and Annika ate and thought it a very good pancake. Afterwards, Pippi invited them into the parlour. There was only one piece of furniture in it. It was an enormous cupboard with many, many little drawers. Pippi opened them one by one and showed Tommy and Annika all the treasures she kept there. There were strange birds' eggs and unusual shells and stones, lovely little boxes, beautiful silver mirrors, a pearl necklace and much more, all bought by Pippi and her father during their travels around the world. Pippi gave her new playmates each a little present as a keepsake.
And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
I think this has to be Gone with the Wind. I've read that 5 or 6 times. I've seen it 5 or 6 times in the cinema as a teenager. You know, in the afternoon show when they would bring basically these big Hollywood films. And I think that definitely is huge scope. And the vast amount of people taking part of it, as well as the historic importance of the themes and the events covered, implicitly inspired me to write Marina.
and equally themes are eternal. War and peace, love and hate. And also, if Scarlett O'Hara is not always palatable, her voice in the book is unfailingly authentic. And that too reminds me of my Catherine in Serena. She rings 100% truth, whatever she does.
Scarlett O'Hara was not beautiful, but men seldom realized it when caught by her charm, as the Tarleton twins were. In her face were too sharply blended the delicate features of her mother, a coast aristocrat of French descent, and the heavy ones of her florid Irish father. But it was an arresting face, pointed of chin, square of jaw. Her eyes were pale green without a touch of hazel, starred with bristly black lashes and slightly tilted at the ends. Above them, her thick black brows slanted upward, cutting a startling oblique line in her magnolia white skin. That skin so prized by Southern women, and so carefully guarded with bonnets, veils, and mittens against hot Georgia suns. Seated with Stuart and Brent Tarleton in the cool shade of the porch of Tara, her father's plantation, that bright April afternoon of 1861, she made a pretty picture.
Liza Ross narrating Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell, which is TB15050. And finally, is there a book you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
This might be A Collector of Worlds by author Ilya Troyanov. And it actually tells about the travels and adventures of Sir Richard Burton, who's not the actor, but a Victorian adventurer and explorer, who sought for the sources of the Nile, when their exact nature and location were the Victorian world's last unsolved riddle. So he disguised himself as a Muslim to participate in the Hajj, and he was a governor of Damascus later on. It's a book that's all about curiosity and the strive for knowledge and about the quest of adventures and never accepting the obvious as an answer. So I like that, especially in these disorienting days of splendid isolation. Let's call it like that, Red.
The Collector of Worlds by Ilya Troyanov is available commercially, although only in print. Ellen Alpston, thank you so much for sharing your passion for reading with the Read On listeners and for being a guest on the show.
Well, I thank you. I'm absolutely honoured.
Alas, that's all we've got time for today. But Read On will be back at the same time next week. And you can always subscribe to the podcast by searching your favourite provider for Read On, the audiobook show. And why not follow us on Twitter? I'm at Redsale, which is REDSZELL, and Robert Kirkwood is at Talking_Books. Thanks to producer Hannah, to all my guests, and to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.